we can just start talking informally, I think, and people can come in. This is when I sent out my list of possible topics, this was when they got a couple of responses favorably. And here's Comas. He's not, has anybody seen him?
Yeah, I seen him at lunch. You know, I was coming from lunch. He was, you know, having lunch with the seminar speaker.
Okay.
So he was there when I was leaving.
I was hoping he would, he said he'd try to come. He was interested in this question, getting into Science Times, and he sent an email to Ken Chang at the New York Times trying to interest him in what's going on here. So I was going to have him report on whether he got any response yet or not. So, but
did he say specifically he would come or just?
No, he said back that he would try to come and be here at least for the first part. So, but we'll see. I'm going to put up something that is an old joke that, oops, whoa. An old joke thing that applies to different fields, but mainly, you know, what he did was communicating directly with the reporter is really the best thing in the starting place for getting your story in the newspaper, in the media somewhere, and that's understanding how the organization is structured, who has the power and all that sort of thing. So this is your basic generic discussion of the newspaper management structure. The publisher leaps tall buildings, the editor leaps short buildings. Your publisher dictates policy to God, the editor talks about it. Managing editor, that's not a running start. Talks with God if the request is approved. The assistant managing editor is occasionally addressed by God. The city editor talks to animals. Let's see that. Features editor prays a lot. Copy editor talks to walls. The intern mumbles to himself. And finally, you get to the reporter, who is God. And this is maybe not totally as true as it used to be in the journalism business, but it's still pretty, but the reporter is the most important person. And there's, you know, a lot of people who try to manipulate the media, especially, you know, some PR people and administrators at certain medical schools, I won't name, think that the way you do it is you go to your buddy, the publisher, or the editor-in-chief and say, tell you those reporters down there to write a story about our thing. Well, you know, that might work once, and you might get a story written about your thing that way, but you sure make an enemy of the reporter down at the bottom of the paper who gets told to do some bogus story because somebody went and told the publisher they wanted them to write a story. The way to get to manipulate the media is to get the reporter to be willing and without coercion to write about the stuff that you want to be written about. So I mean, that this is the most important single point, I think, is that keep in mind that the reporter is the most important person to deal with, and everything else stems from that, basically. I just jotted down a few notes of my own for talking points on this issue about manipulating the media. I mean, the best way to manipulate the media is to be nice to the media. And if you are helpful to reporters, it increases your chances that the reporters will pay attention to what you say when you have something to say to them about your research. So, really, it starts out with returning the reporter's calls. If the reporter calls you about asking for a comment on somebody else's work, you definitely want to call the reporter back and return the call, because if you don't, the chances they'll ever call you to ask about your work just start going really down really fast. It's like, be helpful, provide information, let the reporter know about news that's good you hear about, even when it's not your work, you know, and do stuff like that, then, you know, the reporter's more likely to consider you somebody to go to talk to you about what's going on, and that'll give you the opportunity to let the reporter know about your work, too. This other point about the PIOs, you know, depends a lot on... Oh, that's one of those jargon acronyms that I tell scientists never to use, isn't it? Public Information Officer.
Who is that?
It would be a person who would be in charge of doing things like writing news releases.
At your institution.
Right. At your institution. So most universities have a news office that has people to write news releases and things, and most of the big universities have somebody who's specifically a science public information officer. And it depends on where you are, of course, but most places, the science public information officer really knows what's, you know, who the media people are and things, and can be very helpful in giving advice on how to get word out about what you're doing. And that's, you know, if you have a really good public information officer, your problem is solved, because if you have good work, that'll be a good job of getting the word out. But basically, you know, understanding what... there's an old story about some guy who was a famous public relations expert way back, you know, 100 years ago or whatever, who had this reputation of being the, you know, the great whiz at getting stories on the front page of the best newspapers, and you know, somebody asked, what's the secret about getting your client stories on the front page of the newspaper? He said, the secret is I only take clients who have something newsworthy enough to be on the front page of the newspaper. So, I mean, it really is true that it starts out with actually having something to tell that's a really newsworthy story. But, you know, the question, I guess, really is when it comes to manipulating the media, sometimes it is important and newsworthy, but it isn't immediately obvious how important and newsworthy it is, and you have to figure out ways to show the reporter why and how it's newsworthy, and that involves getting a good sense of the reporter's framework.
And this is what I can ask. I mean, the question I've always wondered about that are, you know, there are some science reporters who actually find stories.
Right.
And there are those that live on press releases.
Right.
And maybe you're going to speak to that as you go along.
Well, that's an excellent point to make. So, press releases are one thing, and a lot of reporters live on press releases. You gotta have to figure out which are those reporters. But you also figure out which are the reporters are the ones who find stories. Okay, well, how do they find those stories? Well, lots of times it's because some scientist calls them up and nobody else and says, hey, I know about a story, you know? And so if you can trick the reporter into thinking the reporter is finding this story that nobody else has, then, you know, that's feeding into that reporter's way of operating. So one really, I think I'd make the point on a later slide, but one really good thing to do is make a practice of, you know, identifying reporters or papers that you think would be interested in your work, but your first contact would not be pushing your work. It would be letting the reporter know, say, hey, you know, I read your stuff, I know you write a lot about this. This guy over here I just saw has this new thing coming out, you might be interested. You're going to be a lot more effective promoting somebody else's research than your own, at least in a first contact, because, you know, reporters have their guard up against people pushing their own stuff.
But I mean, within NASA, you know,
right.
they have different levels of,
yeah.
Propaganda.
Yeah.
They have the full-blown shows, documentaries, mm-hmm. which they have once a month, which are a big deal.
Yes.
These space science updates.
Master for manipulation of the media.
Right. But you know, in those contexts, the, you know, the decision about what's important is basically made by NASA rather than the reporters.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I would hazard to say 80 or 90% of the science stories one sees in, let's say, astrophysics, come from that kind of source.
Yeah.
Other fields of physics don't have agencies that are that adept.
Well, that's right, and hey, I mean, it's bad that that's what happens. I mean, NASA wields way too much control over what gets written and covered, but that's because they're good at doing this manipulation.
But do you think? But I guess my question is, the negative I would say is that speaks poorly about the science reporting community.
Oh yeah, I agree.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, the science reporting community just takes this handout stuff and swallows it because it's most of us do. And it's easy, you know. It's being fed to you, so it reduces the amount of work. You know, a lot of times it's just practical because you're short on time, you're trying to cover lots of different areas. Whoever makes it easiest for you has a natural advantage in getting the thing written about.
But other fields of physics where there's not a government agency that's carrying this out, let's say, the conditional
right.
physics or something.
Right. Well, there's two aspects to that. One is, NASA has the built-in advantage of the space and space exploration and astronomy stuff is more immediately popular and more immediately of interest to a larger audience and some of the other things. So there's that natural advantage. So even if you had a better apparatus in some of the areas, it wouldn't necessarily be as successful.
Well, so this is the question. So, I mean, the NSF doesn't really try to do this, but wants to try to do this, more formal stuff beyond just press releases.
They should. NSF should do way better. And DOE should do way better. And lots of other agencies and organizations should do a lot better than they do. And, for some reason, one of the reasons is NASA got built into its charter from the beginning this huge, it's a small percentage, but a small percentage of a big number of money earmarked for these kinds of activities. So from a budgetary standpoint, NASA's got it way over all the other agencies that don't have that built in from the beginning, which is bad, but that's part of it. But in other agencies, you talk to some of the people in NSF who presumably are in some of the areas that are supposed to be doing this public understanding. Now, they got a guy now who's up there at one level who has newspaper experience and knows a lot more about how it should be done.
Mm-hmm.
Before he was there, they had very little expertise in that area at all. But even he's limited because the money is divided up in these different areas and things. And a lot of the people just don't really understand any of this stuff or how to do it. But you're right. I mean, it should be much better. Putting on of media events is a good way to manipulate the media if you know how to do it. And these NASA TV shows they put on, I mean, they're great because it's an event you can go cover. You got this news element right there. They had this thing today. Reporters around the country can log on, get online and watch it and all that stuff. And it's very cleverly done.
Ask you about this penultimate sentence that nobody ever written anything about it before. You know, it takes years and years to discover something, right? And then you tell me that, okay, at best you contact, imagine find one person who writes about it. And that's it, nobody ever.
Well, that's
nobody would think it's about what's already written.
That's not quite true. This is just a good pitch. If nobody in the news media has ever written about it before.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Right.
Because obviously the snowball effect.
Right. And no, there is a snowball effect. We're starting the snowball here.
The snowball. The manipulation is to create a snowball.
Right.
So that to get to the point, everybody is talking about it.
Right.
And that's exactly the point. Everyone wants to know.
So you can start it by getting that first person. In fact, what is the date today? 22nd? I believe this is the 20th anniversary of the first newspaper story about superstring theory.
Where was that?
Which 20th anniversary?
What was that?
1985, April 22nd, 1985.
Oh, surely that had
to be. Where was it published?
In my paper, I wrote it.
Which was your paper?
Superstring theory. Yeah. Now I wrote it. It was in the Dallas Morning News. I think it was April 21st, 22nd. I think it's 22nd. Anyway, nobody had written a story. I mean, there was the Schwartz and Green thing in 84, which was a big development. But nobody had come, I mean, in those days, there was not anything near like the kind of, you know, it wasn't, you know, the preprint servers and all that stuff. So a lot of stuff came out like that that didn't get covered in the news. I mean, they didn't publish in Science or Nature, so, you know, it wasn't noticed immediately. But I've gone to a talk that Steve Weinberg gave in Dallas. And during his talk, he brought up this development of the short screen thing on superstrings and how this was some really big thing that was going to be really big and that nobody in the media had written about it yet. So I called up Schwartz and some other people and wrote this big story that the 20th anniversary, the first newspaper story on superstring theory. Today.
Uh-huh.
It was in the Dallas Morning News. 2 weeks later, Walter Sullivan in the New York Times then wrote his story in
which year?
1985.
Well,
no, I was
after
you. I was early.
9 months. But it took 9 months?
Yeah, I'm talking.
To leak to the press?
Right.
To get the mind around
in those days, you had nothing like the flow of information you do today.
It is kind of strange because, that thing set off a fire
mm-hmm.
in exactly one place. Maybe Caltech.
Right. Right.
No, they said it. But at Princeton, it was an incredible thing going on. And there was an incredible conference that already the end of that year
mm-hmm.
in Argonne,
mm-hmm.
which was one of the most exciting conferences. I mean, the conference was going to be doing the anomaly. It was taken over by string theory. We already had them at our exchange and probably got right. All of that happened.
And but there were no
it's
reports.
So it's amazing. But it's not as if this was any quiet. This was a major conference in California.
Right.
Argonne National Laboratory. It's much more. It's really weird.
But there was very there were things written like in some of the in you know scientific publications. But not in newspapers. And in those days, there just wasn't that flow of information. There weren't the online sources and things. So,
before the Science Times.
It was a few years after the beginning of Science Times. So the Science Times had only
not a community that
happened.
It's
not a community that returned calls. Right?
That's right.
News info.
Yeah. In those days, there was much.
More a question than initiated.
Right, in those days. But in any case, this is stemming from this, it's about some reporters finding the stories. This is an example of where me, by going out and listening to people talk, I stumbled across this. I wrote a big story, and then 2 weeks later, Walter Sullivan wrote his story in Science Times, which I have no actual evidence that he read my story first, but he probably did. I mean, it was on the Mike Ritter Newswire, which, you know, somebody saw it. Anyway, but what I've read into it or not, the point is not that. The point was, this business of being somebody saying, here's something nobody's written about yet that's a big important thing happening, was a good stimulus for the first story. Then somebody else did it. And then over the next couple of years, lots of other papers started finding out that this was a big thing and started writing stories about superstrings. But it was the beginning of a snowball here was what we're talking about.
But, I mean, I've been on the opposite side of the snowball. I think the snowball thing is what NASA wants to achieve. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been on the other side of it, which is getting a phone call from a reporter 2 weeks before the press release asking me about it. And I had no idea NASA was about to do a press release.
Mm-hmm.
So I told him the whole story. Because I didn't, you know, I had the story, I've been in a conference, I just told everything. And he said,
good for you.
He asked me, no, what was weird is he called me back and he said, were you the designated lead? Because usually they appoint one person to actually tell the reporters enough that they can write the story. And I just had no idea what he was talking about. And I got admonished by NASA.
Maybe you would.
NASA was concerned that if the reporter wrote the article, there would be no snowball.
Yeah.
Because when the press release came out, everybody would say the story's been covered.
Right.
And so that's the other manipulation of the media.
Yeah. That's evil manipulation of the media. That's NASA's, you know. threatening people, not, you know, against talking to the media about stuff before NASA wants to do its controlled release.
The premise is that when you do a press release, you will get 20 stories.
Right.
Right? Whereas if a single reporter finds it, you will get one story.
Right, at that one time, you don't get as big, you don't get as big of a, of an immediate splash. And that's pretty much what the journals and the embargo system is all about, Science and Nature and everything. Okay, it comes out this hour on this day, then everybody can do it all at once, which, you know, that's okay, but it also can discourage people from talking about what's going on in research, so, in a field that's ongoing, so. But if you want to get, that's kind of another realm where if you got a story that's coming out in Science or Nature, then there's a whole operation to get it publicized. But if you have something, if you want a story in Science Times or a feature about some ongoing research, then, you figure out ways to get it to reporters in a way that'll make them likely to want to write about it. And one way is if it's something that nobody else has written about and they can be seen as being at the start of the snowball or whatever, getting it first. That's, important to the reporters is to be able to write something before other reporters do. That's one way you can manipulate them by showing them how this is something they can do before anybody else can do it.
Pierce
your
students.
I did.
Oh, yes, we want to report. Did you get a reply
no,
yet?
No reply. The dead, totally dead line. Yeah, I sent an email, enthusiastic email off to Kenneth Chang at the New York Times earlier this week, trying to get him to come next week. I gave two possible stories, but he hasn't responded at all.
Only one of which.
Well, I think both really involve me.
But I suppose the reason cause is one way thing. You know, we are supposed to reason cause, but reporters, that's up to them, right?
That's right. But if you always return their calls and you're always helpful, that puts you higher on the list when they start thinking, who do I call? Who do I want to find out? What's going on? It would be me. Then you're on their list.
I want to add something to that return call thing. If someone calls you saying they want to run a story on it, don't tell them that it's not quite right now. You can wait a few days. I once made the BBC, and it showed it dead.
That's right.
Go 2 days. So.
Tell them what you can tell them now.
Do it now, and if you don't have anyone there for the interview, do it yourself.
Exactly. Now, my wife has an interesting perspective on this. She's a social worker, and she doesn't do as much anymore. She used to do this program for social service agencies, advocacy agencies, on how to manipulate the media, although she didn't call it that, I don't think. But, so I told her I was going to talk to you about this sort of thing today, and she said, oh, well, I was talking to people who were like doing advocacy. They, scientists just, want, straight factual reports. I said, no, this is advocacy too, they want their work covered, they want issues reported. So she said, okay, well, the first thing I always told them, just remember, journalists are only of average intelligence. And so we ought to have a discussion about that, but it's more true for journalists as a whole than for science journalists, of course. But nevertheless, her point is one of this. There's another point. Don't not talk to the media. I have encountered scientists saying things like this. They refuse to answer calls or talk to the media, and then they gripe at us for quoting people who aren't well qualified to talk to the media. Well, that's what happens when you don't talk. But those are some of her points of advice, and there's more of hers on here that I think are worth mentioning. Return the phone calls thing. And then this little thing here I think is insightful of her is in the course of an interview, how do you manipulate the reporter? And as she points out, there are some times when you might encounter a truly bad reporter who is hostile or a mind made up. I know I'm being recorded, but John Horgan, you're wasting your time trying to tell him that science isn't over or whatever, because he's got his mind made up and he'll twist whatever you say into either supporting what he thinks that it's the end of science, or they'll just say, you don't know, you're wrong, or whatever. That's, I mean, but most reporters are not, we're truly not like that. Most reporters are truly trying to write a good, fair story, and if they're going off on a wrong direction, there's nothing wrong with saying, well, yeah, yeah, but what's really new and important here is really not so much sad as this. And if they're a good reporter, they'll want to know what's the right angle and what's really new and important here. And so if you can steer them away from a wrong direction if you do it in a, you know, reasonably non-confrontational way. You know, if you run that, the reporter is just a jerk kind of person, that's my wife's always saying. Oh, this is another good point you make. I always write thank you notes. Most of the reporters will kind of know this is kind of manipulating you, but that's okay. And especially if you write a thank you note to the reporter's editor saying what a good job the reporter did, that's always an appreciated thing. So,
really?
Yeah.
How do you find out who the reporter is?
Ask Tom.
You can ask the reporter. I mean, you send it to the editor of the paper, you know, the editor of the paper, whoever, depends on who it is. But you can, you know, find out. I mean, it's like, or send a letter to the top editor or the managing editor of the paper, whatever, or an email or whatever. This is sometimes an obvious ploy, but nevertheless, it's a useful thing to do for a number of reasons. But it's all about making yourself appear, or actually being helpful to the reporter in various ways. That makes the reporter more likely to listen to what you have to say when you have something to say. And, you know, now, again, all at the bottom line, at the end of the day, you have to have something worthwhile to say. All the manipulation in the world is not going to work that well if you don't really have something useful. But assuming that there's some good, interesting, new, important science going on that warrants some coverage, these are things that help get it out. Now, I asked some other writers, other reporters, what tips they would give. And there's a wire service writer who said, you know, any research is relevant to the Michael Jackson stuff. Well, now, that's a good point. You can't take that. It's an idea. You can't take that too literally, of course. The point is, any celebrity trial would not. The point here is that anything that is otherwise capturing the airwaves or the news point or the public's attention in some big way, if you've got something going on, there's some research going on that you can figure out how what you've got relates to.
You really think that? Let me give you a.
No, this must be because of the editor, then, right? This makes it more likely the reporter will succeed and get an article on the
right. Right, 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 right.
That's what that's about.
Right.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the reporter's motivations, because that
could be a real case. Somebody called me.
Yeah.
I got a call, which my assistant tried to find out what it was about from. It was a woman who was recommended by Andre Lucasfilm. ABC News do it. So what does she want to talk about? But it's doing a story on Easter, historical truth and resurrection. They want to know about physics, insight into the nature of reality, and things like that. My wife told me, don't get near it. It's not, you know,
I believe
like this, you know.
That might
I can talk about string theory
and
the resurrection
button. I think in this case, that might be one of those cases where you don't call them back. But the general principle remains valuable, that it doesn't have to be the Michael Jackson trial, though. I mean, okay, these cracked brakes on the trains, on the Amtrak.
But I was being serious, because I have gotten, not to this point, this is ABC News, they got pretty weird stuff. And what do you do then? This example, a reporter once called from Hong Kong, some Hong Kong group. And after about 5 minutes, it became clear what he really wanted to do was to get a scientific opinion on Deepak Chopra. And then I started giving him
my well, I think that's all right.
Well, we got into sort of an argument for the pen of him.
Well,
in other words, there are, and this has happened a lot of times. So a lot of, maybe you don't want to call them science journalists,
right,
but there are people who right try to play this game.
Yeah, there are some reporters who you're not going to really want to deal with. I mean, I think that's true. The real issue here is the reporters you do want
to deal with. Another policy might be to just deal with it. I mean, I didn't care too much about the Hong Kong people, so I followed them from what I thought. I mean, I don't think he talks because he had a point of view of his own. Mm-hmm. But should you confront?
I wouldn't necessarily say confront, but I would say, you know, I would not say that you should not disagree. I mean, you should go ahead and disagree. You're not going to really get anywhere most of the time with people like that, with being confronted and really trying to challenge them as what they're doing. But you can certainly disagree clearly and directly. And you know, there's a lot of reporters out there that you're just not really going to be interested in manipulating. You're just going to want to stay away from it. And that's another whole problem. But for the science journalists out there, the ones who are trying to do a good job, how do you get improve your chances for communicating to them? This Michael Jackson thing really is a serious point, because not that it's necessarily Michael Jackson, but something that, and this gets to the question about the editor and the motivation. If there's something like that's getting a lot of sustained coverage, and this is anytime some big thing happens, there's some editor somewhere up there saying, "Oh, we got to find every angle there is to cover on this. What about the science angle? Tell the science writer to write something about why, you know, Michael Jackson is you know, delusional or whatever." And you know, you get these weirdest assignments come down when something happens about these things that you say, "This is totally ridiculous." But they don't want to hear that. But on the other hand, if there was some actual real science going on somewhere that was relevant, they said, then you could come back and say, "Well, I don't know about that, but here's this other science angle we've got that we would want to work." They'd usually be happy with that. But so, you know, I'm just thinking here, sitting, if you're in New York or the East Coast there and the Amtrak train wheels are all cracked and they're going nuts about it, there's got to be some physics research going on somewhere that might be relevant to that.
We're having a program.
Yeah, the earthquake program, there you go.
Fractures.
Sure. So whatever. I mean, this is the sort of thing, if you pay attention to what's going on in the news and what's getting a lot of attention, and you can see how there is some connection, however oblique or whatever, but if you can frame what you're doing in a way that relates it to stuff like that, it improves your chances, because it does. It improves the science
rate. Was your attempt granular flow and the landslide at Lock and Cheetah?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. That's a bit old now. That would have been good in 3 or 4 months.
Right, but exactly. I mean, you could have probably found a way to connect with something like that with something. I mean, it's just getting it in out of your frame of reference in the physics research world into their frame of reference in a way that they can grasp how they can present it in a way that would make it seem, you know, significant to people, primarily the other editors, but readers too. And that's really the meaning. If you look for connections, you know, that's one of the best ways to get them, because when stuff like that is hot, reporters are looking for how they can get their piece of that big story. Okay, another common answer from other reporters asks, give us your cell phone numbers. that really boosts your chances of being on the A-list of scientists if they want to know what's going on. And this point I made earlier, if you alert them to other people's work, really what you do, you get together and you trade off, okay, I want this, you want that. If you call them and tell them about my work, I'll call them and tell them about your work, would be a possibly effective ploy in some cases. But, you know, it's called, you know, it's like being a news source. If you become a source, then you're somebody who reporters will listen to, and, you know, the day will come when you have something good that they'll know that you're a reliable person to talk to. So, let's see, I think other points. Do I have any other points? These are just basically some of the same things. One thing, Piers, you know, your email I thought lacked one aspect, which was identifying an angle.
Yeah.
You know, this is an interesting field of research, really good going on, and that's fine. You got to take it that one step further and say, here's the interesting new angle to this, or the interesting approach, or some aspect of this. Pick out, you know, some even small piece of the research that has something can somehow hook them in some way and be the entree into the rest of it. That's I mean, if you're talking about, you know, quantum phase transitions or something like that, that's not going to immediately grab anybody. But even quantum phase transitions are important things. I'm sure you could come up with some reasons why they're important for a lot of things. And start with one of those and say, and this is just part of this bigger whole field of quantum phase transitions where all this neat stuff is going on. It's that finding the specific concrete sharp hook that you can build the rest of the story on. It's an important part of selling them and showing them how it can be a story. And that, you know, somehow find a way to get some attention-grabbing aspect. So, I mean, even if you have something that's really good, that's really worth a story, you're competing with all the other science in the world. And this is, you know, this is one of the problems with the way, and in other fields, I mean, in sports, it's so much better because, you know, you've got a basketball writer and a football writer and a baseball writer and a Major League Baseball writer and, you know, NBA writer and college basketball. You got it all broken down, and everybody has their own little niche. In science, you got one or maybe in some cases two people who are doing every damn discipline. So you got to find out some way to get their attention why your particular area has got something worth saying now. If you can come up with some catchy phrase, you know, some scientists in some areas are better than at this than others. I have to say, I think condensed matter physics is probably less skillful as a rule than something like cosmologists in coming up with the catchy, clever phrases. I mean, it's like, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just harder to come up with catchy, clever phrases, but it really does help. It really does help get somebody interested, a reporter interested, if they can have some snappy phrase to attach to it. I mean, that's why, you know, black holes really, you know, that was a great phrase to use to describe some pretty complicated physics, and it made it possible for people to write about it without, you know, knowing all that was behind it. I mean, if you were like talking about, you know, I asked John Wheeler, you know, about him coming up with that phrase, and his story is he was talking, giving a talk toward the end of, I guess it was 67, after the pulsar discovery, and he kept saying gravitationally completely collapsed object over and over again. And there was somebody in the audience, he said, just call it a black hole. And so said, okay, and he thought that was good. He doesn't even know who it was who shouted it out. But it was, you know, obviously, these phrases. In fact, I've got a plan to do a little experiment, but I don't know if this will work or not. But I've been reading a few papers, and, you know, I frequently go over I go through the preprint server and the commenced matter papers and everything. And I've kind of made a list of terms and phrases show up all the time that I don't really have a clue what they are, but, you know, maybe I'd see a good story idea if I knew what some of these terms were. And I try to look them up. I mean, I pick up physics dictionaries and things, and a lot of them just aren't in there. Or, you know, you go through 6 or 7 physics dictionaries before you find this one term, and then it's not in another. The next term isn't in that dictionary. So it's not so obvious. But anyway, what I might do is send out a list of some of these terms. Just have anybody here who wants to, you know, propose their little catchphrase definition or something that would, even a short sentence or something that would try to capture what that was all about. I mean, and see, you know, maybe just test everybody out here, see if they can come up with some examples of how to really think about making catchier phrases. But it really does help. If you can put the top of a news release right off the top of the bat, you know, we call this the Big Bang theory of the universe. Well, you got a hook there. I mean, it's so much better than talking about, you know, the condo effect. I mean, it's just one of the ways to get through to people. So even without beginning to have anybody have any actual understanding of it, if you give them a phrase, it can motivate them to try to find out enough more about it to write it. And it's it is one of the areas where I think physics and condensed matter physics doesn't do as well as some of the other science. Although some of the biology stuff is even worse. I mean, some of the language they use is even more impenetrable. One of the subsequent sessions, next Friday I won't be here, won't be able to do one, but then in May, in the sessions May, one of them I'll want to specifically talk about this language and writing issue and taking the technical language into the common language. And maybe I use this, I'll send this out first and we'll get some examples to talk about. But that's a big part of getting to the reporters and getting to them. So, but I was emphasizing, and if you didn't want to hear right at the very beginning, the first point I made was how the reporter is really important. And it is critical to... if you want to get a story somewhere, you find out who's the reporter who is likely to write it and figure out how to get to that reporter somewhere or another. And maybe it's a long-term project with some reporters, and maybe it's a reporter you can just email and get to quickly. But one way or another, if you understand what the reporter's needs are and then try to help the reporter meet those needs, that really boosts your chances.
Could you talk a little bit more about that aspect of it? Because that's the thing I just don't really understand. You know, if I'm a science reporter in a newspaper, mm-hmm. a science magazine, as for people who are freelance, for example, mm-hmm. They're getting their stories from press releases. They're getting their stories from not only beating the bushes with their network of people, but their motivation is what?
The motivation is to get a good story. Okay, that's the motivation. I mean, there are some subsidiary motivations here that come in. I mean, pleasing your editor or your boss, yeah, there's some need to do that, that some people do a better job of than others. I wasn't as good at pleasing my boss as some people are. But the prime motivation is getting a good story. What you want to be able to do is say, man, I wrote a really good story today. I got a really good story today, and this is really neat, interesting. Nobody else has ever done it. That phrase I had up there before. So that's the motivation. So how do you do that? Well, the way some people do it is they just focus on the writing. Okay? They don't care about going out and getting the reporting. They don't care and go about and really finding the best fact.
So there's some who are content to work just with press releases.
Exactly.
But to be the one that crafted the best written story from that press release.
Yeah, and those are people who we all, most of us mostly despise, but there are people who that's their thing. They want to write the most elegant and, you know, it's fun. You know, they supposedly care a little bit, but they don't really that much. And of course, there's you know, it's like any other field, any other business, any profession. There's, you know, a mass of them who it's just a job. They got to write something. They get the press release, they write up, get it in, they get their paycheck. There are others who really try harder to do a little bit better and stuff. And then there are the ones at the top of the field who are really going after the best stories that nobody else has and do the best job, get it right, get it done, and write it well on top of all that. So, you know, you want to get good stories. And so, and a lot of the time, you know, they'll pitch a story to a reporter and they won't do it. And it's not because they thought it was bad or dumb or they don't like you or they didn't want to do it, but it didn't raise quite to the level of what they're trying to do, which is they want to get an even better story than that somewhere. So they're looking for stories that make a really high bar. And they're, you know, not all that many of those that happen all the time. So, but it's a particularly helpful thing to show that here's something that's like that snowball issue. Here's something that's at the beginning of a, that's going to be a snowball, and you can get in at the beginning if you write this now. And if you can show them that, relate it, show them how it's something that's can be framed as a story like that that has a lot of significance, but it hasn't been noticed a lot yet.
Well, suppose it already started. I mean, suppose already have few, you know, initial help to sustain it. Suppose they're not in a situation, you know, essentially already some places wrote about it.
Right.
But it's how to
and find a new angle.
Whatever, but how to sustain it, how to keep going.
By finding the next new angle. If something has already started, there's something that stuff has already been written about something and it's out there as a general thing. What you want to do then is find, okay, what's some aspect of this thing that people have started talking about hasn't been brought up yet? What's been overlooked? What's a new development? What's something that's been there that nobody ever noticed before?
I suspect, you know, that the readership of Dallas Daily News is very different, substantially different from readership of, say, New Scientist.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, whatever was said in New Scientist, the people of Dallas Daily News didn't read it.
Right.
So.
Right.
So the new angle is not, doesn't seem to be so kind of crucial, you know, for that really.
Well, it's not crucial for the readers out there who didn't read New Scientist, but for the reporter who did read New Scientist, one of the things that would motivate that reporter again is to be able to do something beyond what New Scientist already did, even though the readers don't know about it.
Nobody knows about it.
The reporter wants to do something different from what other reporters have done. And that doesn't mean that the reporter wouldn't write a story about it, but they'll want to say, okay, what angle can I bring to this that wasn't in the other story?
But when snowball starts, it starts at such a fast pace that from one story to another story, there's simply no time for the actual new development, really.
There's snowballs on different scales.
Yeah, that's different scales, multiple
okay,
scales.
Okay, there's the quick news thing where bunches of papers write it all at once because something came out in the Nature or somewhere. But then there's the stuff that starts out slow and then gradually it works kind of like an autocatalytic chemical reaction where, you know, the stories come out and then they produce more stories which produce more stories.
You hear a false
vacuum. But it takes off. But reporters always looking for the new angle. Some way they can show that they've got something new, and they can write the same topic. This is, I think, somewhere up there. To make a point, you can't sell a story very well. You say you should write a story about this topic. You have to have some point to make about the topic, like. Here's this topic that's very interesting, and it will, you know, improve airline security. Or here's, you know, that nobody ever realized this provides, you know, something to do with, you know, safety, fighting terrorism or something that nobody ever realized this could be a tool for fighting terror.
This thing I gave to you, how the departmental officer who was
right.
something said, all this is on the physics.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important during the war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Obviously, complete nonsense. You know, I was kind of quite upset about that. Without asking me, you know, without my knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because everybody talks about this for a couple of years ago, actually, or
mm-hmm.
more. I mean,
well, if, you know.
It can't be more silly than the airplane searches.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it doesn't have to be that this point is the real point, okay? It doesn't have to be that the point I'm talking about is the actual real point of the research. It has to be that this point is a way to call attention to the real research, and then get the real, what you would ideally, even if the point that you use to get attention is not the main point, but it's a way to get attention so that you can then get to the main point or the real point. And that's a price that you sometimes have to pay, because this is that you're competing with everything else out there. You've got to come up with some way of getting attention. And if you can connect it to something that's attention getting, it doesn't have to be that that's the main point of the research. It just has to be that the research, I mean, it should be an honest connection. It shouldn't be that you just totally lie and say this is related to this to get attention. But it just, any connection at all can make it something that the reporter is more likely to stop and pay attention to and find out more about. And then if you have to use that tangential point to get attention, as long as you kind of at least then get some of the real stuff to trail along, that's accomplishing something.
I mean, there are, how do you get reporters to do stories that are clearly important, but require work?
Well, that's almost impossible. I mean, the reason it's impossible is because very few reporters have the time to do the work. Even there's a lot of reporters just don't want to bother with work, but there are some who would, but they don't have the time to do the work. Because the most important stories often are the ones that really take a lot of work to do and to do well. And, you know, in most newspaper situations, you just don't have it. I mean, you do not have time to do very much. And you maybe have time to pick out one thing to do, you know, in a year that takes a little work. But
how many stories reporters write, you know, typically per week, per month?
Oh, it varies completely. I know at smaller papers, you know, the smaller papers you have a report. I know reporters who worked at smaller papers, they would write 500 stories a year. So maybe that's a little exaggeration. But more than one a day.
About two stories a day.
More than one per day, yeah. Because, you know, they would write, for certain, they would be expected to write a story every day of some sort. And then on top of that, you know, once if they got that story done earlier in the day, they'd work on something else, and then you'd have a few more up here and there. So that's the extreme. But that, at smaller papers, that's not uncommon at all. At a typical paper for a typical reporter, you know, a typical... My paper is a little different because when I was there, we had, a bigger staff of people and everybody didn't have to write every something all the time. So maybe 100 stories a year would be typical for a science writer at our paper. You know, maybe, you know, or maybe not that many in some years depending on what was going on. But in more recently it was fewer just because there was less space in the paper for stories we would have written. But, you know, 75 or 100 a year, you know, 20 or 30 big stories and, you know, and then smaller stories. But, you know, a typical newspaper reporter generally goes to work and writes a story in a given day, and then the next day writes another story. And maybe some days they don't write a story because, you know, something else is going on. Some reporters write just daily stories, so they write almost every day. Other reporters typically will spend 2 or 3 weeks on each story they do, so they only write 20 or 30 stories a year, something like that.
When they write a story per day, does that mean that it's start to finish, or do they write them parallel?
Well, sometimes there would be some parallel, but But often, it's just, you come in the morning, here's a story you've got to do. I mean, if you're lucky, maybe you got to make a call or two the day before to get started, you know, late in the afternoon, but probably not, because you're probably finishing up some story from that day. So you would come in and start with a typical daily semester. If they're journals, okay, they give you the stuff all a week in advance, because their philosophy is that way you can have, you don't have to rush out a story, you can take a week and call everybody and, well, you wait for the last day anyway, because you got all this other stuff you do. I mean, some days on some stories that are important enough, you know, you start early. But you come in the morning and you start putting out phone calls to the people you think you should talk to write this story, and you start writing, and then your calls come in and you get some answers, and you write a little more, and a call comes in, and you write a little more, you get somebody the first time, and they actually answer their phone the first time, you say, oh, great, now. And, you know, by around 4 o'clock, some editor is saying, how's that story? And you start trying to get it done by 5, so your first editor can read it and give it back to you and tell you what to do by 6, and then it's gone, and it's in the paper the next day. So.
How important are pictures?
Pictures are important in some respects for some publications. So, for example, the stories I've just been talking about were like daily stories. Now, when we had a science section where it comes out once a week, the process is a lot different. Then you're going to work over several days, probably. You're going to talk to more people. And there's where pictures and things become important, because you're trying to put this whole section together and you can't just be all type all in place. And if a story has really good visual elements like pictures, or there can be good graphics that can go with it that are easy and clear to understand, that helps a lot, because that makes it more likely the story will get more prominently displayed. But it's well, most of the science sections now, except for, you know, Science Times at the New York Times, are pretty much being disbanded, so it's not that important anymore. And there's more just of those shorter daily stories and less of the longer science section stories.
Science Times is being disbanded?
I have no reason to believe that it's being disbanded or that there's any talk about disbanding it, but everybody else, all sections that most other papers are being disbanded. I mean, the Newsday had it really for a long time, a pretty good section. They disbanded. Other sections they kind of kept, but they just made them all health sections, not real science sections. So it's limited this kind of reporting where you write the longer, better stories, and which is really bad for things like, you know, what we're talking about here, the features on ongoing research, because those things have a hard time making it into data papers. But for science sections and things, they're ideal.
It seems like there's some national publications, I would call the New York Times a national publication, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal,
mm-hmm.
which has a lot more analysis than most newspapers, and at least in some areas, it seemed to give reporters the resources and time to put together a series.
Right.
I don't know if that's true for any science reporting, but
it is to some extent. Well, I mean, yeah, some of the bigger papers, they do, I mean, the New York Times does occasionally have science writers do the bigger pieces and series and things. In other papers, it happens sometimes. It just doesn't happen systematically. It's okay, you know, most other papers, okay, if you went and proposed, say, why don't we do a series on this important science thing, you might get okay to do it, but you might not, and you wouldn't be able to do that very often, and there's just not as much of it as could be done. And, you know, if you have a very small staff of science writers to begin with, you're making a trade-off there to say, okay, do we basically stop writing any of the basic science news that comes out for the next couple months and just put our writer on writing this big series or something? Well, sometimes you might be willing to do that, but it's a tough trade-off.
Well, when Margaret Wertheim was here, she's committed to writing for people who don't know anything about science, is the first approximation, and she, it sounds like the reporter might have a similar motivation in general. She uses hooks that people are already interested in to try to get them interested in science. So what are people interested in? History, religion, feminism, music. Mm-hmm. And you can argue whether or not she's successful or to the extent to which this is the way to go, but she's absolutely right that the publications that emphasize those things have far greater circulation than the publications that emphasize science, like Scientific American.
You have science writing in Glamour magazine.
She showed us the circulation figures, and there's a lot to support her approach. Maybe we shouldn't be afraid of those kind of books.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I have a little bit different take on it because I think you should be writing for people. I think science journalism should be writing about science for people, not to have a knowledge or training in science, but for people who have an interest in knowing what's going on in science. If you go too far towards just trying to write for people who have no interest in science to begin with, then you're going to leave the people who do have an interest in science, of which there are many, without as much substance, and you're not going to, you know.
Yeah, but the women who are leaping through the Glamour magazines.
No, that's a different thing.
For example, yeah, well, I know Janet Conrad's trying to do that.
Right. I mean, that's a different thing. That's fine to also
get science in there.
Yeah.
Get a Glamour magazine reporter to show up at a science conference.
Yeah. No, I think that's fine. But I mean, it's. I think you're going to get limited results because it's where's the economics of doing that for the publications. You know, is Glamour's going to have to sit there and say, is this going to boost our circulation if we have more stories like this?
What
was
the beefcake calendar?
Yeah.
The
yeah.
one that had
Rocky Call.
Rocky
yeah.
Others, yeah.
Yeah. That was
the
that was
Aaron
Hopkins. That was
yeah,
something that you might report on is women in physics, for example, because of controversies about women.
No, I think there could be. You could find things for things like that would be worth doing. And I mean, I think that's a little bit of a different thing than having systematic, you know, journalistic coverage of science, which is one thing. But this is another thing, which is also a good element for people to pursue. And, you know, I don't know how successful that could ultimately be, but surely, I mean, this is part of why it's still important to have science journalism in newspapers and not just in Scientific American, because they reach this broader spectrum of people, which you would ideally like to reach. So. Finding the hooks that get more people to read about it is exactly what you should do.
So I guess the other thing, I mean, I don't read them, but Time and Newsweek, I think of weekly magazines, I mean, I just don't read them.
Right.
Yeah. What is that, one page?
Less than they used to be. Yeah. But Time still has more than one, I think. Right. Newsweek, is pretty lame in their science, and Time is not. Time used to really have a really good size science stuff, and it's not what it used to be. But I think they still have.
Some. Well, I mean, yeah. They have these. Big
stories. Yeah, the big cover features like that they'll do from time to time. This is kind of baffling because they always say when they do a big science cover feature, it boosts their newsstand sales a lot. And it's, well, yeah, that's great. Maybe you should do more, huh? Well, no, we can't afford that. But it's like it's like the public. There's plenty of public interest in this stuff out there. There's no doubt about that. It's the economics of providing the resources to do more of it that doesn't make sense to a lot of publishers. So.
People are certainly interested in medicine, disease, health issues.
Oh yeah, I mean, which is. Again, a somewhat slightly different arena from what I'm talking about. The medical writing is something that most papers still do pay attention to, although they do it pretty poorly for the most part because it doesn't have the science-informed reporting in a lot of cases. And so the coverage of some of these issues like the overweight, obesity, death rate things and stuff like that, where you can read the newspaper report and really come away scratching your head about what the actual evidence really is that these people are all arguing about, because they just don't get into the science of how this is all done. But that's a component. The medical research, biomedical research, medical findings and things is certainly a component of the whole picture of informing people on scientific stuff. But
what happened when you have issues like you were serving when you were in the newspaper, and it would be a political story with scientific, like global warming, or the energy bill. It's like where the science journalists consulted, experts on that.
Consulted and ignored.
Much like the government.
It depends on how a particular paper is structured things, but for the most part there's this really bad gulf between, you know, the national political coverage of issues and then the science department. And you see this time and time again where, you know, the political reporter will get a hold of something like that's got the science on it, and they'll do their take on it, or they'll think something should be like this. And somebody said, well, you better ask the science department about it. And they'll ask the science department, and they'll say, no, that's all wrong. And then they'll go back and say, well, we asked the science department about it, but you know how they are. So, I could probably come up with one or two times where they actually listen, but for the most part, it's a separate thing, and it doesn't integrate the science into the decision-making process, and it comes out bad in a lot of, well, that's the way it is in a lot of places. I mean, it's, some papers are better than others at getting the science writers into, but it's, I think they're a little better from what I can tell than other papers, because they have a bigger staff of science writers, and the science writers have more opportunity to get involved. The New York Times. The LA Times has somebody who actually does science policy coverage pretty much, and that's a better deal than at most papers.
Well, in the New York Times, they even have a crossover. I mean, James Lanz is now...
Yeah.
He might be switching.
Yeah, I think
he's not a science, but I'm saying he's somebody who's a science writer who's now writing...
Yeah, which is always good to have somebody with science writing background doing other things.
I'm not sure. In fact, I actually talked to him. He was, just as he was on vacation from Iraq in Amsterdam, invited him to come to that conference we had.
Yeah.
And he was saying, well, he's doing hard for him. I asked him whether he's quitting and moving.
Whether he's leaving science.
Vacation in Iraq?
To Iraq is...
But likewise,
it sounds like he's establishing his credentials.
Yeah, no, I think, yeah.
He's, at the important level.
Yeah.
So you can move up at the Times.
Well, probably, yeah.
I don't remember his name, but one of the Times reporter had science reporter was a Vietnam War.
Yeah, Malcolm Brown.
So he's gone the other way.
Yeah, he Malcolm Brown, he's not doing it anymore, but he was science reporter at Times, who had previously been, you know, right. Vietnam and all that stuff.
He got the Pulitzer
for him. Yeah, for his war coverage, yeah.
The thing I'm wondering about is, you know, politicians go and meet with the editors of papers.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking when you were talking about this question of advocacy amongst editors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there evidence of advocacy to editorial boards saying the importance of science?
You know who it is? It's these scientists who are promoting creationism, who are always making appointments with the editorial boards to go in and say, why don't we do better coverage of creationism?
Others aren't trying, or they?
So, not very much. Now, there are, what you'll see sometimes, people like, university chancellors or whatever, who might want to talk about their new push to get a biotech institute into our school, and they'll go to the editorial board and talk about projects like that. But mostly it's...
Somebody like
director of the NSF, or
president of the National Academy,
going to
talk. Yeah, exactly.
Actually, it does happen. Rita Caldwell did come once to talk to our editorial board in Dallas, shortly after she first took over NSF. But it was that's kind of a rare.
But it seems to me that that's the loop that can help help the, you know, help talk to the editors.
Yeah, but see, we got a terminological gap here, because who they're talking to is the editorial page editors. The editorial board is the editorial page.
Oh, sorry. Okay. I guess what I mean is those who...
The editors who are supervising the news site and the science reporters and everything do not have that same mechanism in place. I mean, that's where it's, you know, you could write them a letter or something, but they don't have that input mechanism that the editorial page does. So, I mean, that's all separate. So that's...
So I think this idea that David said of the National Academy makes a lot of sense, right? If you get the president of the National Academy to show up and talk to the publisher of Time Magazine to say, you know, we feel that there should be more science reporting, maybe that would help. It can't hurt, I don't think.
It probably couldn't hurt. I don't know that they'd listen to him any more than they'd listen to me, but they might.
Everybody's arguing for their special interest.
Carl Sagan used to tell the story about how, I think it was the Washington Post, he went to talk to the editorial board or to the editor or something and congratulated him because, you know, he wanted to first of all say how fine it was that you were the one paper that didn't have an astrology column in the paper to be an example for other papers. And so, you know, the next week, the Washington Post started the astrology column because the editor didn't know they didn't have an astrology column. And they corrected that oversight. But I do think there's something to be said, though, for identifying, maybe not the president of the National Academy of Sciences, but the, president of, a major corporation talking to the publisher of a major newspaper chain, where it's more a peer-to-peer kind of thing, where you get somebody like that who, is where they perceive themselves to be on this equal level, where, you know, publisher of a newspaper is going to.
So, you know, the scientist. Person for a Raytheon who depends on having technically talented people to.
Yeah, exactly. Company. Something like that. I think more communication of that nature might be good to go on at that level.
Yeah, they belong to the same country.
Exactly. I thought there's the possibility. But ultimately, you got to remember, though, that the publisher, the people at the top, science coverage, science journalism, whatever, is this little thing down at this bottom of this long tree of stuff that they're concerned about. And, man, you know, it is very hard to get them to take it seriously. It's just really, to make that an important issue for a publisher, who's worried about stuff, you know, like the cost of newsprint and declining circulation and advertising.
But this is no different than the challenge of scientists to advocate within the government.
It's hard in both cases. I mean, I'm not suggesting that it shouldn't be attempted or done, but just that it's you know, not easy to get results. So.
Thanks.
Okay.